RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with royal designers.
For over four decades, Gerald Scarfe has been at the forefront of political cartooning. During that time, very few personalities have escaped the rapier-like slashes of his vicious pen. His work has outraged and offended many, but still he continues with his weekly spot in the Sunday Times. With no formal art training, but a lot of natural talent, he started out as a humble commercial artist, illustrating goods for sale in advertisements. After sending examples of his work to Punch magazine in the late 50s, he started to receive a trickle of freelance commissions and was later engaged by Punch as a staff cartoonist. His association with Private Eye magazine in the 60s put him at the heart of British satire and was to be the foundation for his well-known ink-splattered style. With over 51-man shows to his name and numerous books, films, operas, ballets and theatre productions under his belt, and more recently his association with Disney, I was intrigued to know what keeps him going on this sometimes vicious treadmill. I met him at his waterside home in the heart of London's Chelsea.
Gerald, I've been looking through your last book, which was one published in 2005, Drawing Blood, which spans 45 years of your life and work. And for me, being a designer, it's refreshing to have a book that really tells a visual biography rather than densely packed. But within all of that, there was some fascinating things. I'm going to start very much where all things should start, which is at the beginning, and just talk a little bit about your early life. Your mother was a teacher and your father worked in banking. So did you have any inspiration from your parents at all in terms of what you ultimately went on to do?
Well, no, I came from no sort of artistic background at all. And my father was in banking and my mother was a schoolteacher before she married, and then she became a housewife. I had an uncle who had a commercial art studio, but that was slightly misleading because the sort of commercial art he did was retouching photographs and graphic designing without actually drawing. I worked there for a short time, yes. A horrible short time. I worked at the Elephant Castle, and I think my main job was carrying.
I'm going to talk about that in a minute, actually.
Okay. I just go back to the beginning.
I just wanted to really talk for a little while about the fact that you, as a child, you were asthmatic.
To such
an extent that you were, you were in bed for a lot of the time.
Sure.
And would draw and read comics and presumably, as so many children that are gifted with drawing, create your own world because you're cut off from your friends and school.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, I was an asthmatic child, which I think had a tremendous effect on me because I was a lonely child, a frightened child. It was wartime. I was an only child. And I think drawing became my way of experiencing everything and putting down my fears on paper. And I was a very, very frightened child.
Because
of the asthma, everybody at that time thought one would die with asthma, and I think my parents were continually frightened I was going to peg out, and I did have a lot of doctors coming around and giving me adrenaline and other sort of drugs, and it was a pretty frightening time. Of course, being a child, I accepted it and didn't realize the danger that they felt, but I'm sure they visited their fear on me. So it was kind of fearful atmosphere in which I grew up, and I think people have since said maybe that accounts for some of the blackness of my drawings, the drawings of death and all that sort of stuff hovering around, especially in the early drawings. So I think it became to me merely a way of explaining the world to myself, of exorcising the fears that I felt about everything around me. On top of that, I was frightened, or learned to be frightened, about the war. Hitler was bombing London and we were going downstairs into the cellar to hide from the bombs which were falling above, and strange enough, I was frightened at that time. I remember when I was very young of a wolf, which I was determined was down in the cellar. I wasn't so much worried about Hitler, but it was this wolf that I thought was down in the cellar where we had to go in the shelter. So when I look back now, I can see I was a very timid, frightened, shy, lonely, which kind of sounds like a sob story, but I mean, it all got better later when I began to draw and I began to explore things through drawing. I I can't imagine how I would have survived without drawing, really. It was my one sort of life belt at that time.
So it's a way of really expressing, you know, your personality through your drawings, because basically your personality seemed to be very cosseted because of the illness and because of the fear of infection or whatever your parents may have thought, or the people around you, that you were kind of untouchable, possibly. Sort of thing.
Yes, I mean, it was. I mean, and at that time, the drugs for asthma were very primitive.
Yeah.
Today, they're quite sophisticated. And although I still have asthma, I take a sort of dose of thing, a daily dose of thing, something which holds it all at bay. But at that time, it was a very... And I did have a lot of horrid kind of hospital experiences as well when I had an asthmatic attack, which was pretty ferocious. And if you see anybody with true asthma, it's quite distressing.
Yeah.
You really think they're not going to be able to take the next breath, and that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
And so I was hospitalised quite a lot. And in those days, hospitals were mixed. You know, the children weren't in a separate ward necessarily, and I was in wards with adults, and I do remember people dying around me. One man staggering out of his bed and walking to the window and flinging it open and gasping for air and then falling on the floor and dying.
Okay.
So I think that this, of course, you know, this sort of in a way accounts for my drawings, but there was another part to my life as well, a very enjoyable childhood as well.
Yes.
And I had uncles and aunts who lived in the country, and I used to go and visit them. So there are lots of happy things as well.
You also moved around quite a lot. Your father was in the RAF in the war. I think you had to move from A to B.
My father was in the RAF, and as you say, and which meant that we moved quite a lot. It was still quite a nomadic life, really, I suppose, which is slightly also very unsettling as a child.
Yes.
We never seemed to be very long in the same place. The idea was to follow him. My mother followed my father around in order to keep the family together, sort of thing, the three of us.
Now, you had no conventional art school training, but I think certainly reading through your book, one of your teachers recognised your talent, and actually early on really sort of told you to think of yourself as an artist.
He did, yes, and he sent me one. I think I was about 15, and in this particular school, my schooling was very, very ragged and erratic because of the illness all the time, all the way through. I'm pretty ill-educated, really. I went to a lot of schools and different teachers and so forth, but everybody always said to me, you can draw well, you're a good drawer. This particular headmaster thought that was my strength, and that I should give up trying to struggle with these other subjects that I wasn't able to concentrate on, like algebra and history and so forth, because I was continually interrupted by the asthma when I was being taught those and having to be absent from school. But the art was constant, and I think he recognised that, and he sent me to, I think it must have been St Martin's or somewhere like that, with a note saying, although this boy is 15 and you don't normally accept them until they're 16 or 17, please make an exception here. And I went along with my father to this interview, and the head of St Martin's, or whoever it happened to be, said, well, right, yeah, okay, well, let's see your work. And I said, well, I haven't brought any. You haven't brought any? And he said, well, how are we to judge? I said, and I was embarrassed, my father was embarrassed. But because neither of us had any thought about it, an interview to my father would have been a verbal thing. You know, he was in banking and different thing. So anyway, the head of the school said, well, listen, anyway, I think it's a bit early. You know, normally we take people at 60 and everything. So I lost the opportunity just from... And he, as I went out of the door, he said, now remember this. Wherever you go in future, never go without your portfolio.
Well, a little later, I mean, you know, when you were 16, you had... a drawing published in The Eagle, and I, you know, for the listeners, I point out that The Eagle, which is a comic that was published in the 1950s, was revolutionary in that it was so futuristic looking. It had fantastic drawings. It had these center spreads that had exploded sort of diagrammatic drawings of the QE2, the comet, whatever it might have been. And they were, like you, I was a great fan. And it's interesting that I discovered, talking to many other royal designers, that The Eagle was also a great trigger for them. But in your case, you actually was inspired enough to send drawings into The Eagle. You had a drawing published, and then later you won a competition, which is published in your book.
Yes, I did. It was a competition to make an advertisement for Ingersoll watches. And I, to my amazement, won first prize. It was the most amazing thing. And I think in many ways that sort of made me feel it was possible to actually publish and make a living out of that. There was something in it that sort of almost convinced me. Incidentally, I always tell the story that I won first prize, and one of these sort of runners-up was David Hockney of Bradford, it said at the bottom.
Yes, and that's interesting because your paths sort of cross much later, and you also enter into similar areas of creative pursuit. So we could talk about that a little later. But I want to move on now to going back to your uncle who ran a commercial art studio, and you secured a job there in his agency. Which I think you referred to as a graphic designer. I would think it's more of a commercial artist, because you were, from what I understand, you were drawing, very much drawing, and you were particularly the blankets. And again, I think it's interesting for any listener to know that at that time, and indeed right up to probably the 1970s, newspapers were rather crudely printed, the dots being the 65 dots per square inch. So photographic reproduction was very bad. So everything was drawn. I mean, it was either scrapperboard, line drawings, or these very, very linear sort of grey and black and mid-tone drawings. And you were very good at blankets. That was your, or for a while.
Well, I became good at everything. I mean, I say immodestly, because I really think, although I hated the whole experience, that it taught me to draw absolutely everything faithfully, anything faithfully. I could draw a bicycle, a cup, a pencil, a box of crayons, a television, radios, whatever. I could draw them, and they were just put almost on a conveyor belt in front of me, and I had to draw these. But the thing that I hated about it was that I had to make them look good and glossy and fabulous, like all advertising. Yeah. The whole point is to make people buy it.
Yeah.
And it somehow got to me, the fact that here was I, privileged in a way to be an artist, and I was prostituting my talents by drawing things, not in a truthful way, but in an idealized way.
Yeah.
And I often think when I later went on to become a caricaturist, I tipped viciously to the other side of the spectrum, because I wanted to tell the truth, the ultra truth. But certainly in the studio itself, I can say that they taught me how to draw some very, you know, drawing a shoe is quite difficult. I had to draw a lot of shoes, I had to draw a lot of bicycles, I say, and all sorts of weird objects.
I remember myself working in a very similar commercial art studio in the early 60s, and it was a revelation, because you had these experts in particular fields. You had retouchers who would retouch photographs so that they became almost illustrations in their own right, because they'd take all the mid-tones out and make it very, you know, lots of highlights. So there was retouchers, and there was scraperboard artists, and there were a whole range of people. And if one used one's sort of intelligence, you could pick up so many sort of fantastic tricks and techniques and use it that way as a kind of college. And as you didn't actually attend college, I know you went on to go to St. Martin's to do life classes, but it probably was a great grounding for you for just to have confidence and control over various mediums.
It was, and I must say that, you know, although I went in and had to sort of, I insisted, because he was my uncle, you know, on being treated like everybody else, and I insisted on lugging buckets of coal up the stairs for these coal stoves that they had in all the offices, and, you know, and running errands. It was Dickensian, yes, and I always, at that time, I remember thinking to myself, if I ever make it, you know, I'll always remember this perfect Dickensian beginning. But very soon, I mean, they began to realize that I could draw, and I could draw faithfully, and I got more and more work, and very, very soon became one of the mainstays of the studio.
Yes.
And they used to give me masses of stuff to do. I was extremely badly paid, and eventually I went freelance.
Yes, you became disillusioned. I mean, you just said you referred to yourself as prostituting yourself, and possibly that was that link back with that original teacher who said, think of yourself as an artist, perhaps. That's what stuck in your mind.
Very probably, but I think all artists know sort of what they're doing and what they're after, and I wasn't after what I was doing. I wanted to be doing something else. I knew there was something else there somewhere for me to do, but I didn't know what, because I had no teachers and no background of art, yeah. And I didn't really know how to draw, and I have drawings, you know, of the age of 16, which are very, very kind of competent illustrations of, say, the fright at the front at Brighton, or there's some sort of French houses I remember I drew in France. Architecturally sound, you know, the watercolour is fine, everything about them is fine, especially for someone who hasn't really had any tuition. But they're boring, you know, they're just sort of photographic reproductions of what we can see, and I always thought that an artist's job really was to bring something new,
yeah.
You know, a new vision, so that people could re-see things that they have grown used to and re-sort, see them in, through a different perspective, through yeah. a different eye. And I just wasn't doing that, and it frustrated me, and I still now, even now, feel late, because I missed somehow 10 years of my life while I was sort of buggering around doing things I didn't really want to do.
Sure, sure. But perhaps without that, you wouldn't be the person
who knows?
Are.
Well, none of us are. You know, there's always that argument, but I mean, exactly. I might have been a better.
But actually, moving on to, you know, what you ultimately wanted to do was to, which is expressing what was in your own mind rather than having to, you know, be at the beck and call of you know, someone else telling you to draw this or draw that. One of your heroes was Ronald Searle, who's of course another royal designer, and I'd love you to tell that little story that sort of makes the link much later when you met him in France.
Sure, yeah, I know what you mean. I really desperately needed someone to look to as a sort of a hero, you know, someone who could actually tell me how to become a cartoonist, which is what I wanted to do at that time. I could see that by going to being a cartoonist, I could actually find a little road out of what I was doing. So Ronald Searle became my hero, and at about the age of 15-16 I used to cycle down to his house in Bayswater from where I lived in Hampstead with the idea of ringing his doorbell and asking him, how do you become a cartoonist? I used to cycle down, and I can still see the house where he lived. It was set back from the road, and there was an outside wall, and set in the wall was a gate with a sort of circular top, an archway, with this black door there, and alongside was a doorbell, and I used to go up to this doorbell composing what I would say. But I could never, ever make my finger reach this doorbell. I tried to push it so many times. I made this journey, I don't know how many times down there, but I always ended up feeling rather sort of dejected, getting back on my bike and cycling round in the road and going home, disappointed. And it was years, years later that Ronald Searle, of course, when I became a cartoonist, got to know of me, and we did finally meet once, I think. But about 2 years ago, my wife took me down to Provence, where he lives now. He's about 84.
Yes.
Still very hale and hearty, you know, still very, still
in,
still sort of trying to, you know, work and do, you know, when I say trying to work, he's like all of us waiting for the next job and slightly cross that, you know, work hasn't come in and all that sort of thing. We went down, we had this meal in Provence, and at a sort of Michelin-starred restaurant that he frequents there, and on my place setting in the restaurant was a little tiny package about 3 inches square, done up in a beautiful bow, and I said, oh, is that for me? He said, yes, but it's just a little something, you know, it's nothing. I said, shall I open it now? And he said, yeah, of course. And I opened it up, and it was a doorbell, and it had this sweet note on it saying, please ring any time. So he's a very, very sweet man.
Lovely story,
yeah.
I think. And maybe maybe it would have been interesting to have known, had you have actually got the courage up to ring that bell, what would have happened. However,
yes, I mean, it's a life full of those ifs, isn't it?
You then, just going back again to that period, you took a drawing course at the V&A, and you applied to the Royal College of Art, and you were accepted. But left after only a few days. What happened?
Well, I think that I had been working as a professional artist for some 8 years, I suppose, around about that time. Well, no, who knows? 4 or 5, I can't remember the exact time. Let's say I've been working for about 6 years as a professional artist. I felt the need for some kind of academic acclaim. I think that's what it was. And I applied to the Royal College, and they accepted me. And I went for the first week or so, I think, but I realized when I was there I just could not go back to school. I could not go back to college. I do remember, strangely enough, one of the professors saying, could you carry my books upstairs for me? Whether this was to put me in my place or not, I don't know. But I thought, bugger this. And I just gave up there and then and thought all I needed really was the knowledge that I was thus good. I was good enough to be accepted by the Royal College, which at that time, and probably still is, one of the top colleges for art. I'm often, well, there again, you're going to say, what would have happened if I'd stayed on? Because that is something that does, I think, you know, my drawings are huge. They're sort of a metre high and a half a metre wide. Mm. So I often feel I am a frustrated painter, really. Mm. I certainly have delusions of grandeur.
Actually, your book, which the introduction of which actually is a sort of is rather charming little story about the artist, i.e. the artist in quotes. And it's interesting that we're sitting in this room and not too far away from here. Rossetti was in residence, and many other artists in this area. So you live in an area that was frequented by painters.
Yeah.
And you make that point at the beginning of your book that everyone imagines this, but and then you sort of bring it down to earth and say, but what about the cartoonist? So do you have the very fact that you're a cartoonist is neither here nor there. I think the visual expression of what you do is the most powerful thing, whether you're working in oils or large canvases or whether you're working on line boards or tent paper, whatever it might be. But you seem to, is it because over the years the word cartoonist seems to have a sort of second class citizenship feel, knowing all of the accolades that you've won and obviously that you've been hugely successful, yet you made that point at the very beginning of your book.
Yes, because I think it's undoubtedly true there is a demarcation mark there that between the fine artist and the cartoonist. I mean, as you say, I've been amazingly lucky, considering where I started from as a sickly, asthmatic child without any training at all. I've been able to work in all sorts of areas of theatre and film and animation and opera and ballet and so forth. I've been very, very lucky. But the word cartoonist, we all know, does have a stigma attached to it. And people do not regard cartoonists as fully fledged artists in the same way that they would regard someone who is presenting something for the Turner Prize. Mm. There is a difference there, and I don't think one will ever get over it. I can't see how one will. And I hope and think that most cartoonists don't care about it. Maybe there are some that do. Mm. There must have been some yen in me to sort of move on. I think I get very, very bored when I'm just operating as a cartoonist. Mm. I get bored drawing Tony Blair and Margaret Thatcher over and over again. And that made me branch sideways and look for other things.
Well, we'll move on to that a little later.
Yes.
That kind of curiosity obviously led you into lots of different areas, which we'll talk about. I just want to keep on track at the moment. I mean, after your short-lived life with the Royal College, you left your uncle's agency, you became fully freelance. You felt obviously confident enough to do that. You started sending cartoons to magazines and newspapers, and you were accepted by Punch.
Hmm.
And then later actually worked for Punch full time for a couple of years. So that must have been really a turning point in terms of your being recognised as having a particular talent in the area of cartoons, characters,
yes,
and so forth.
I began to send cartoons to Punch, and to my amazement they accepted some. And I then became what there's a magazine called Advertisers Weekly, or
yes,
it was.
Yes.
And I had a picture on the front of that as the new face of Punch.
Ah.
I had become, you know, recognized by Punch anyway as someone who had brought a new look to yes, cartooning, or caricature, or whatever you call it. And I worked there for many years. And of course, this was pretty good. I was still doing some freelance work for commercial projects and making quite a lot of money there. And also, in those days, they paid 7 guineas for a cartoon, which was quite a lot of money in those
Actually,
days.
Always guineas as well.
Always guineas. I don't know, it's
sort of slightly upmarket.
Upmarket.
It's a fiver, isn't it?
Yes. yes, this is slightly to give it that kind of panache, I suppose, the guinea on there. But I was doing extremely well as a single young man at the time financially, and bought myself cars and all sorts of things. That was where the feeling of success came, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Because Punch in those days was the place to be,
yes,
if you were a caricaturist,
yes,
or a cartoonist. There was nowhere else, really. Private Eye didn't exist at that point.
You, around about that time, also, I read that you became interested in anatomy, and you went to some courses, or certainly became rather interested. And I wondered, it would seem to me that the interest in anatomy, with entrails and intestines and all that, kind of maybe fed into what later became a much more kind of overt sort of style, which, you know, you were kind of taking the insides and putting them on the outside,
yes,
just like Richard Rogers used to do with buildings in the 70s.
Yeah, I think it was to do
on the outside.
It was to do with my lack of training that I felt. And although I turned down the Royal College, I still felt that I should really learn how to draw truly and faithfully. And I bought doctor's medical books, which showed absolutely everything about the body, you know, the bones and the sinews and the muscles and the tissues and the bloodstream and so forth. And it made me very much realize that we are these living pieces of meat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of that began to feed into my drawings. And I drew very, very sort of detailed drawings at the time, every sort of pustule and hair and pimple and nostrils were explored, and everything was, and as you say, the drawings almost had their insides on the outsides. And then people began to say about that point, I was like Hieronymus Bosch, I was like Hogarth, I was like Francis Bacon. They drew all these parallels because the type of drawings I were making were a bit disturbing.
When you were clearly beginning to establish that very personal style, it was given, I would say, it was certainly that more flamboyant approach, it was given full flight in Private Eye when you started to work with them, where you were sort of unrestricted.
Yes, it was a bit of luck, really, that Private Eye started around that time, because I was able to channel everything I'd discovered into Private Eye, and they encouraged me. Peter Cook and Richard Ingrams and co, Willie Rushton, all encouraged me to go for it. And I think it was Willie Rushton who actually turned me onto political figures, because up until then I was drawing anonymous figures, us, you know, and mankind. I was drawing whatever, not anyone in particular, but I began to, with their encouragement, to produce caricatures. And most of the people they wanted drawn were people they didn't like.
Yes.
And I was able to, you know, come into my full flight of Scarfisms, or whatever they call them in those days.
And, yes.
And
much of the horror of even some of Private Eye's readers, they complained bitterly about the grotesqueness.
Well, they did. And I made some drawings from New Statesman at the time, which they called, somebody wrote in and said they were lavatory wall artistry. And someone else wrote back and said, what better place to look at them than in the lavatory? But even Richard Ingrams himself in Private Eye, I did picture of Harold Wilson, the Prime Minister at the time, with his tongue up Lyndon Johnson's bottom.
Yeah.
And Richard thought that was a bit much because it was actually into his anus, you know. So he wanted the tongue moved sort of lower down the cheek. So even for private eye in those days, they were a bit strong. But I was in my element. I realized I'd found myself. Yes. I'd realized at that point for the first time that I was somewhere, going somewhere that I felt happy with. And I think it was a reaction against the advertising, this bland, you know, glossy advertising work. I went right to the other side of the coin, the other side of the spectrum, and told the ultra truth as I saw it through my drawings.
You then, a little after that, you started to work in the area of reportage, visual journalism, and you were working for Esquire and the Daily Mail, and later you were hired by Harold Evans, which is in the kind of heyday of the Sunday Times, I think, when it was, you know, the Sunday Times was seen as the Sunday newspaper,
yes,
the magazine,
yeah, absolutely,
with it and so forth, and you were sent to various hotspots around the world to record things, mostly still in black and white. You hadn't really sort of at that point in time.
Well, colour wasn't used much in newspapers.
No.
Magazines occasionally.
At around that time, which is, we're talking about the sort of mid-60s, you know, that magical moment in Britain where everything seemed to be coming together, you produced a drawing for The Observer, which was a naked man and woman. It was pulled, and they found it too disturbing, and interestingly, out of that, another writer, a writer who was working for the Observer at the time, John Berger, was so infuriated that pulling this this drawing that he resigned from the...
He did. I felt rather bad about that I'd caused that to happen, but they were very, very cautious. I mean, the drawings now that I was doing then, if we produced them now, they wouldn't be so shocking. You've got to remember they were against a rather bland background at the time.
Yes.
And although we talk of the swinging 60s, in actual fact, the beginning of them were almost as boring as the 50s.
Yes.
They took some time to get going.
Yes.
Retrospectively, they look extremely exciting. And I had a lot of difficulty, especially when I left Private Eye and went first of all to the Daily Mail, who hired me at some enormous price and gave me an E-type Jaguar as a present to encourage me. When I went there, although they wanted me for my name, the notoriety of my name at that time, they didn't want to print what I did. They wanted me to do something else. I think they found it extremely difficult. So someone said to me at the time, you've got to imagine that the Daily Mail goes into all these millions of homes where it's part of the family. And when you've got one of your drawings in there, it's just as though the family dog has shat on the breakfast table. You know, it's that shocking.
Yes.
To find something in their friendly newspaper. So to compensate for that, I think they began to send me to far-flung places in the world. They sent me to Vietnam to draw there. Maybe they thought, cruel artist, a cruel situation. But it was very difficult for me to make the drawings in a daily newspaper, a big newspaper, that I had been making in this little magazine called Private Eye.
Mm.
I had quite a difficult period, and even when I joined the Sunday Times, I didn't have a good time in the Daily Mail. I didn't like it at all, and I left there and then joined the Sunday Times in 1967, and because of Harry Evans, who was a sort of pioneering editor, mm. very well thought of, and did some amazing journalism at the time.
Mm.
He rang me up and said, I think you're a radical and I'm a radical and we should work together, and I went to Sunday. But even Harry
didn't know what to do with me.
No, he sent me, you know, on various reportage things. I went, you know, to draw De Gaulle in Paris. I went to the Six-Day War in the Middle East. They sent me to Northern Ireland, I remember, and where I was hijacked by the IRA. Took my Cortina off me. So I had a very strange... And I didn't quite know how to handle reportage. There was a magazine also called Encounter, and they sent me to New York to draw sort of New York intellectuals at the time, people like Mark Rothko and Leonard Bernstein, Arthur Miller, a whole batch of artists and writers. And I ended up in this rather sort of strange half-caricature, half-realistic drawing style.
Mm.
I wasn't happy, because of course when one's making a cartoon, it's completely out of one's imagination. And I can go let my imagination fly. When you are doing reportage, you want a certain amount of reality in the drawing, otherwise it loses its authenticity.
Well, actually something struck me on that, as you pointed that out. I noticed on re-looking at the Vietnam material and the Calcutta, the cholera Calcutta, that those drawings are very, one wouldn't say beautiful, but they're very gentle. And I was wondering whether that was simply because what you were looking at was so horrific that you didn't need to do anything. You didn't need to exaggerate. You recorded that moment, and it's all there on the page, very simply.
Sure. Before I went to Vietnam, I just watched the Vietnam War on television. I was very much against it. But the pictures on television were almost sort of John Wayne gung-ho, with helicopters with Marines leaping out with a grass fanning out on each side, very romantic looking. It's easy to make war look romantic. I was just appalled when I went there by the incompetence of it all, and the fact, first of all, that they were sort of 19-year-old boys, American boys, who'd been flown across the other side of the world and told to kill these people. And the Vietnamese people themselves were the most gentle people in the world, who, like most of us, just want to get on with their lives, have families, and have some fun. They were all caught up in this ghastly, ghastly situation and managed in Maine by these professional soldiers who were, half of them seemed to be incompetent. It's a horrific situation. Anyone who thinks war is a well-marshaled, ordered thing has just got to go there and see what chaos it is. And we read all continually, stories now about friendly fire and all that sort of thing. So I found it very, very difficult while I was there to draw the actual situation. I ended up, in many ways, drawing the gentleness of the country, the flora and the fauna, and the gentle Vietnamese people. And later on, you mentioned Calcutta. When I went to Calcutta, I had to go and draw cholera victims. And I can remember now, sort of driving outside Calcutta in this jeep to the hospital, and it was pouring with rain and sort of chocolate coloured mud everywhere with potholes in a row. We splashed our way to this hospital. Well, they call it a hospital. It was actually a sort of corrugated iron barn. And when I went inside, I was absolutely appalled because the floor was covered with people suffering from and dying from cholera. And it was my job as an artist to report this, to put it down. I just couldn't handle it. I just thought, I cannot go and draw these people and invade their privacy at this terrible moment in their lives. But a photographer that I was with, he had no such worries about it. And he was in there with his Nikon, taking photograph, clicking this and clicking that, getting this angle and that angle. I felt rotten, the Sunday Sun had flown me halfway around the world, and I was just standing out in the rain, clutching my armpits, worrying about what. I thought, well, come on, get yourself together, and maybe if I make a drawing, someone will do something about it. They'll send some food or some money. It was my job, in fact, to report. I then went back in and started drawing these people who were dying, and when I start drawing, a strange thing happens. My drawing becomes a kind of barrier between me and the pain that I'm seeing, or I'm filtering the pain that I'm seeing into the drawing, and I'm concerned with the graphic considerations like foreshortenings and how to get this expression on the face or all that sort of thing. So all that takes over, and I very soon was drawing away and sending drawings back. But I always find it difficult, and I don't think these days I would be quite so happy to fly off to the other side of the world I'm not sure I'd want to go to Iraq, for instance. Not only about a personal safety, but about drawing those very, very unpleasant situations, because the drawings that I make, although they are unpleasant, they're a cry against that unpleasantness. They're a cry against the horror that I see. They're not advocating that horror. They're not like a horror movie poster that's telling you this, how horrible this movie is and you should go and see it. Mine are the opposite. I'm saying, for Christ's sake, can't we stop this? For God's sake, why do we all do this to one another? So it's a very difficult area.
Well, moving back into the comfort of your studio, having brought you back from Vietnam and Calcutta, going back to Private Eye for a moment, there was a very famous set of drawings that you produced for Private Eye, which is a whole raft of personalities, most famously the one of Lord Snowden, naked, with a camera slung between his legs with an extended telephoto lens, which is kind of, I found, I remember that vividly at the time, and this got me flicking through your book, because I'm sure you're aware of it, but this phallus crops up time and time. I counted 20 versions of this device in the book, either flaccid or erect or otherwise.
Yeah.
It seems to be your favourite symbol.
Well, it's a very good symbol, I must say, for potency and so forth. And also, I mean, I've drawn various American presidents with an erect rocket, you know, yeah, which is their sign of potency. But I made up my mind when I started drawing back in those early sort of teen days, when I felt so bad about drawing luxury goods, I should draw everything about life. I should draw, you know, us and our human condition in every possible aspect. And a very, very big part of our life is sex, you know. And so I have had no compunction, really, about drawing female or male genitalia. It's quite strange, actually, that when I took that book, Drawing Blood, to China, they printed it in China, and I flew to China to check the proofs. And they said that they couldn't print any drawings of Chairman Mao. And I said, why not? And they didn't seem to be able to answer that. It's incredible that Chairman Mao has such a hold over them, although he's dead. But they also wouldn't print any erect memorabilia. They also wouldn't print any erect phalluses. I said, why not? And they said, oh, too big. And I said, well, that's the way we are in Britain. But, you know, it's very strange. And, of course, that makes the point how free I am in Britain, you know, compared with other countries to do what I want to do. But to answer your question about, you know, yes, I do. I drew a flaccid and erect penises because I think they're, you know, they're part of us. They're part of life. Yeah. And I'm not shy about, you know, drawing anything, really. I can't think of anything. I wouldn't, you know, there's certain things I wouldn't want to draw, I suppose, like paedophilia and so forth, you know. There are certain things I would find very uncomfortable to do.
There is there's one remarkable drawing towards the end of the book, and I'd be interested to know whether it was actually published or not, and that is Princess Di lying flat on her back with her legs open, and protruding from between her legs, from her vagina, is Prince Charles.
No, that's not Princess Di, that's Camilla.
Is it?
It's Camilla.
Okay, Camilla.
Because Prince Charles famously said, poor guy, on some email that was reported in the paper, that he would like to be Camilla's Tampax. So that's really a drawing of that. But I mean,
was that published?
It was published. Strangely enough, I made a film about, or a film was made of me about 3 years ago, called Drawing Blood, and they showed it in that. The BBC, BBC Two, showed that of Charles peeping out of her vagina. There's also another one, since you mentioned Princess Di, of her being sort of buggered by a pig.
That's right.
I made a drawing of Princess Diana in, this is a separate drawing, I made a drawing of Princess Diana in a white, virgin white dress, mixing with the press, and the press I drew as pigs, although I'm one of them myself, pigs of the press, and they're all in their muck and mire and crap and so forth, and the suggestion is that because she's mixing with them, courting them, the mire that they're in is coming off on her virgin white dress. In other words, she is being affected by going along with the press.
Mm.
I then took that a stage further, where she's actually being buggered by a pig who is the press. And I've tried to draw her face, the character of her face, so you can't quite make out whether she's outraged at being raped or she's going along with it. because that was the position with Princess Diana.
Yes,
you know, you
were,
she did actually
collude.
Yes, court with the court, the press, and so forth. So, you know, that's the other thing about caricature. It isn't just getting a likeness. It's saying something about the character of the person at the same time.
As I said earlier, that often people be kind of outraged with some of the images that you depict. And going briefly back to that Private Eye collection, there was a particularly grotesque portrait of Mick Jagger, you got a letter from some of his fans, and I think they said, "For what you've done to our Mick, we're going to get you and cut your balls off."
Yeah.
And did you get many letters like that?
It was signed by 114 schoolgirls. It was three cut classes in this particular school. I have to tell you, they didn't catch me, but I did at that time get a lot of letters objecting to my work. There were letters saying, "How dare I depict President Nixon in such and such a way?" I mean, there was a lot of reaction at that time, and people wrote to me and said how sorry they were for me because I had to live with my ghastly imaginations, whereas they could just tear up the newspaper and throw it away. Mm. I was stuck with these horrible thoughts, which I don't think is true in a way. I always feel that I'm able to exorcise my thoughts. If I have anything ghastly and I draw it, I've got it out of my system, yeah, really, therapeutically.
Yeah. You said earlier, or you alluded to the fact that, you know, you got to a point where you were, you know, drawing many well-known characters, and you were thinking of branching out into other areas, and so I'm going to go on now to that period. I mean, you started producing some 3D models in papier-mâché. You then got involved in animation. You won an award for Long Drawn Out Trip, which ultimately led on to, it came to the attention of Pink Floyd, I think Roger Waters, probably, was it Roger Waters?
Well, two of them saw it on BBC Two individually, I think, and said we should get this guy to work with us.
And so you went on to create Wish You Were Here, initially, and then of course The Wall, which mm-hmm. was their tour set design and so forth that you were involved with, but then later it became a feature film.
Yeah.
And that meant that you were in a much more collaborative, or supposedly collaborative, atmosphere with other creatives.
Yeah.
And you obviously I know that the history of that film was a different director and it was a different sort of structure, but ultimately Alan Parker, who was, I think, producing the film at the time, came in as director.
Yeah.
And clearly had a different view, the film probably ended up not quite as you would have personally liked, and probably not the way he would have liked. So just tell me a little bit about working with other creators who have a vision, and how difficult or easy that is.
Well, I think it's very good as an antidote to an artist's life, which is very, very lonely. You sit alone in your garret or gallery or whatever it is, studio, and you paint and draw away, and you have only perhaps your wife or partner to show these paintings to, and it's quite a lonely life. So when one works in the collaboration, it's terrific, in as much as you can go to other people and say, "What do you think of this?" all, and then you can get ideas from them, and they say, "Well, a bit more this way, a bit more that way." So I love collaborations, but of course the other side of that is that you don't get your way entirely. You have to sort of cut your cloth to the general pattern rather than... I must say, most of the people I've worked with, like Peter Hall and Roger Waters, all have had the idea, the thought, that if you hire an artist to design something, then you get what that artist does.
Yes.
And to try and change what he's doing is wrong.
Yes.
You either have him for what he does. And so in general, there isn't a great deal of interference, really, at all from people. So I think collaboration is wonderful. I mean, it was particularly bloody in The Wall, in as much as Roger came to me very, very early on with the raw tapes of The Wall, and I began to put story. It was in this house we're sitting in now, in Chelsea here. I began to put a storyboard on the wall, a visual storyboard of what he was writing in his lyrics. And together we worked out a pattern of what could be a film, ultimately. But first of all, we had to work on the records, you know, the record sleeve and the illustrations for that, where I invented these or designed these characters. We then did the road show, which I made animated films to project behind the band and drew all the programs and T-shirts and gone as well. So I was heavily involved for about 6-7 years with the Pink Floyd, and went on the road with them all the time and travelled around with them. Where was I going? I
don't know, this is the film and the collaboration.
Yes, so I already had I'd already got a kind of track record going with Roger. We'd worked on the record, we worked on the stage show. When it came to doing the movie, it was Roger's idea to bring in Alan Parker because he was British and he would understand the subject matter. And Parker could get the money together. I think that was it. And when we first started off, I was the director together with a cameraman called Michael Saracen.
Yes, I know.
And we were directing, and we did a lot of shooting at Earl's Court with the live shows and so forth. And then Alan Parker took over because, for one reason, he could get the money together, whereas, no one would know my name as a film producer. They knew his. He'd got a track record in Hollywood. And I then went on to being kind of general designer and designer and writer of the animation sequences. I think it was bloody in as much because Alan, naturally, as a director, comes in and expects to have complete control. Yeah. Roger and I, on our part, were not about to let go of what we'd been working on for the past three or four years. And so there was this slight tugging at the beginning, which, exacerbated as time went on, and things got worse and worse. And someone said at the time, if you put three megalomaniacs in a room together, what do you expect? You're bound to get this. Each one of us wanted to control. Roger and I were working together, really, and we remained friends, and we played snooker and drank beer and together. So that was Parker, I think, felt left out of it, rather as though we were established. And he had a caricature done of me and Roger, in which Roger was the bully, and I was Inky, his friend. And we were dressed as schoolboys. And it was a feeling he had that he was being pushed out, and we didn't want him to take over completely. So it was pretty nasty. I always remember that I used to drive down to Pinewood in the latter days when we were doing all the end bits of the film, with a bottle of Jack Daniels on the passenger seat beside me. This is 9 o'clock in the morning. I used to go down there. I'm not a big drinker, but I had to have a slug before I went in to face this. This what I knew was going to be bloody hard stuff. I mean, films are pretty nasty areas anyway. Yes. And they're very, very. So there's a lot of money involved and a lot of,
But were you with when the final cut was screened? Were you happy with the contribution that you made? Or?
Well, I don't know what I felt really, because of course one knows it so intimately, and like all artists, you only see the bits that you haven't got right. You only see the bits that are the worst bits, and you kind of think, oh damn, if only I'd got that right and got this right. I think it's the same with everything I produce. I don't see the brilliant, the good bits. As time passes by, putting together this book, drawing blood, has made me look back over 45 to 50 years of my work.
Yes.
And there is a kind of feeling of despair. Is that all there is, as Peggy Lee sang? Is that all there is to fire?
Yeah.
But there's also occasionally that little moment when you think, oh, well, that wasn't that bad. That wasn't as bad as I thought it was.
Mm.
That was, more hopeful than I thought it was. So artists are very self-critical. I am, anyway.
Yes. Well, I mean,
and when it came to the film, I thought it was. I was glad it was over. And I've met people since who said, "Wow, didn't that change your life?" I said, "Well, no, not really. It was just a job. It was just another job, and it's become now a cult film."
Yes.
And somehow struck the nerve of the youth at that time.
Yes.
And it's doing so now with my sons, who are in their 20s, early 20s. since their late teens, they've known about Pink Floyd. I mean, and, you know, it's okay to know Pink
Floyd.
Well,
they've had a resurgence anyway in recent years.
Yes, they have.
And I think that's what we talked earlier about the internet, and I think, you know, with DVDs and different versions and background material, and there is a new audience. And so
there's a new audience, but it does show it still works in some way. Yes. And I mean, I don't quite see that myself, because I was part of it, and it just felt as though, as I say, I was doing a job.
That experience, and obviously your relationship with Pink Floyd, and the animation work you were doing that led on throughout the 80s to opera, theatre design, more animation. So you became a very established theatrical designer, and I know you're still working in those areas. And then again, you another step change in the 90s. You moved into directing films, and you made five films for the BBC. It was a thematic series, and you had one on Scarf on sex and paradise, class. And so on. And I remember seeing those when they were out, and you were able to, you seemed to be giving your head in those films.
I was,
you were able to.
Yeah.
And that seemed pretty remarkable, because I don't know of any other artist who has been given free rein to make so many documentaries like that.
It came about really because I produced a book called Scarf by Scarf in the 80s, and about, this was autobiographical, and Arena, BBC Arena, wanted me to make a film of it, and they suggested I should direct it, since it was about me, so it should be an autobiographical direction. I had directed before, in the past. I made a film about Hogarth, you know, earlier on.
Yes.
So I had some experience, and I take to it, I like it. As Orson Welles says, there's nothing, no bigger train set in the world than directing a film. I think when I produced this film, this autobiographical film, Scarf by Scarf,
yeah,
it received a BAFTA.
That's right.
Thereupon, everybody suddenly saw me as good, you know, a good director, because I got a BAFTA and so forth. And I had lots of offers. And then I began to produce this series of films, which were terrific, I must say, to do, because, as you say, they gave me carte blanche. I wrote them, I directed them, I appeared in them, I had every kind of sort of help that I could have helped. And a lot of my friends, you know, Ian McKellen and so forth, were in the films, Terry Jones. And so we had great fun. What ultimately happened there? I made about a dozen films for Channel 4 and for BBC. I began to feel after a while that, much as I loved it, making films was my mistress, and that my true wife was my art. And to make a film, it takes at least 6 months of your life. You've got to write it, you've got to, you know, shoot it, edit it. It all takes a long time before it actually gets out there. It's about 6 months from conception to actually going out there. And I also began to feel, you know, like I knew about a lot of things, it was just you make this huge piece of film, and then you go, it'd gone in half an hour or an hour, or it was on television, that was that, you know, nothing left.
Yeah.
Whereas with a drawing, something's left, something remains. And I sort of gave up films. I'm sorry that I had to, in a way, because I do love doing it. And went back to drawing again, because I think my drawing began to suffer during that period. I don't think I was putting my shoulder to the wheel, as I tried to do all the time still. So yeah, that's how that little episode came and went in my life.
Yes. And then going back,
and then I went on.
Hercules appeared on the scene.
Yes, and then I went to Hercules came about, like most of the things in my life, and by accident. Two students who had known my work in Chicago when I worked for Time magazine back in the 70s. They'd been to my exhibitions. I had exhibitions in New York and Chicago of my sculptures and drawings. And they were kind enough to say they'd been fans of mine. And they'd had a big hit with a Disney film called The Little Mermaid, and they were able to do more or less what they wanted to. And they wrote to me and said that they were producing Hercules, would I like to be involved? And I thought, you bet, because as a child, I was such a Disney fan. Apart from Ronald Searle, I think Disney is the biggest influence on me. And people have said, you and Disney, you know, what's this grotesque artist doing with Disney and so forth? But I could see the connection. And the other thing that attracted me was that, being Hercules, it was about mythological Greece, and I'd always been very keen on mythology, Greek mythology and Greek architecture and Greek statues, and so the archaic period of Greek art and so forth. So it all kind of fitted. And this was wonderful because they gave me a whole year to design the characters. Of course, I was doing other things at the same time. And I flew back and forth between here and Hollywood many times and had lots of meetings and so forth. And they were extremely kind to me. I was very nervous because you hear many bad stories about Hollywood, how they chew up writers like Tom Stoppard. Yeah. And I mean, from Scott Fitzgerald onwards.
Anybody.
They chew them up, spit them out, and some, you know, writers get rewrites and rewrites and rewrites and eventually take their name off. Anyway. It was lovely. I always say it's the nearest thing I'll ever get to being Tom Cruise, really, because I was treated royally out there.
Yeah.
So after a year of designing the characters, I then met all the animators. And it's quite a small initial group of animators who take the characters.
Mm.
And each animator takes and stays with a character.
Yeah.
One character, one animator will draw Hercules. Another one will draw Hades.
Okay.
So and they stay with them, and they're almost like the actors, and they take the script, and they make the personality happen.
Yeah.
They're very clever. I grew to, you know, really admire those top animators out there who can show with what are initially still drawings, something that tricks you into thinking it's true love or anger or, you know, all these emotions that they can express through drawing, moving drawing.
Mm.
And I've always been fascinated by the animation. And I've always been fascinated by animation because I think it's such an untried art. You can imagine what someone like Picasso or Matisse would have done with
it.
It doesn't have to be little bunny rabbits hopping around, Tom and Jerry and all that.
Yeah.
It's living art. It could be living abstracts. It could be living anything.
Yes.
But it's moving art.
Yes.
And I still think it hasn't really been, you know, fully explored.
What's your view? I mean, this is going off the subject, but it's actually the relevant, your view of digital animation. One notable animator is a man called John Lasseter, who you probably know of.
I don't know,
well,
I should know.
John Lasseter has been most recently responsible for Cars. He was responsible for Toy Story.
Yes,
and originally a little film, the very first serious piece of work, was only 2.5 minutes long. It was called Luxo Junior, about two anglepoise lamps, which he created.
No, I now you remind me, I do know about John Lasseter, and I do think his work's terrific, and especially in the case of Toy Story, where, you know, it was used, computer animation was used in a way it could not be used. Because it was dealing with toys, you know.
Mm.
I think it's less successful when it comes to the human being.
Yes.
My sons play, you know, these football matches on the computer, and they are very realistic, but they're not.
No.
And when I was working on Hercules for Disney, there was a sequence which particularly suited computer animation, and that was the beast, the Hydra. The Hydra, as you remember, when you cut off one head, two grew. If you cut those two off, four grew.
Yes.
Perfect thing for a computer to do. So they did this, I think, 1 minute sequence on computer. It took about 6 months to do.
Mm.
And when they looked at it, it looked computerized. And then they had to spend another 6 months to make it look graphic. And I said to them eventually, wouldn't it have been better to do it in the old Walt Disney way of actually hand drawing? And they said, yeah, probably, and cheaper too.
Yeah.
So I think computer animation is brilliant, used in certain areas of fantasy, and as I said, the toys were, and, you know, animated cars and so forth. But when it comes to animating humans, it's less successful.
Yes, yes. Well, we're coming very much to the end now. I mean, last year, interestingly enough, you were voted Cartoonist of the Year by the British Press Award. Was that the first time you were voted Cartoonist of the Year? Because I couldn't find any.
No, I mean, I was voted in, I think in 1967 was the first award I got as a cartoonist, and that was the What the Papers Say Award.
Yes, yes, yes.
Which I got also last year. I got a special prize, the judges' prize they call it, which is probably just for staying in there a long time prize. Yes, I mean, there's been this huge kind of gap between the 60s and now.
Yes.
I've had you know, I've won a BAFTA, yes, I've won, yes, the Laurence Olivier Award for my theatrical costumes, I've won animation awards, I've won...
This is your core discipline, which is,
yes,
seems very odd.
And maybe it's because I'm a strange sort of cartoonist. I'm a kind of part-time cartoonist. I do it, but I do many, many other things. And I'm a slightly confusing member of the club in that way. And I'm not sure whether the people see me as strictly as a cartoonist. I think they do. I mean, of course, because of the enormous power of newspapers, the Sunday Times sells, or is read by 2 million a week, shall we say. Of course, I'm known as a caricaturist in general throughout the land, those who do know me. Mm. Much more than I would be known as an opera designer, because, yeah, how many, you know, take forever for 2 million people to see an opera.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas, yeah. So I think I am known, but amongst the fraternity itself, I seem to be a strange beast.
Mm.
And although I've been in there, as you know, 50 years.
Yes, indeed, you've been working for the Sunday Times for 37 years.
40.
Or maybe.
It's 40 this year.
And you've had 51 man shows. You've had many.
Oh, many more than that. That's old information.
One would say, cup run over. I mean, is there anything else on the horizon now? What is there anything you've
Whenever I'm asked that, of course, I have to say more of the same, really. I can't think of anything. There are things that I probably would have wanted to do in the past. I wanted to do Wagner's Ring at one time, but then. And just recently, someone's asked me to illustrate a book of Wagner's Ring, and I haven't got round to it, or I'm not sure whether I'll do it or not.
So that'll be three books then, probably.
Yes, three books it will be, yes. Three very large books with very large drawings. But I'm still in touch with various kind of rock people, you know, who are... There are always things bubbling along in the entertainment and show business world, most of which don't happen.
Yeah.
I'm working on another book at the moment, and I'm working with a couple of one rock star in particular on some project, and I continue drawing in the Sunday Times every week, and that's like my platform, and it's also a regular amount of money that comes in, and it's you know, it's a habit too.
Yes.
And I've been doing that, as you say, for 40, 50 years.
Well, on that happy note, thank you very much for it, Scar.
Pleasure.